Welcome back to GI Pearls, the gastroenterology and hepatology literature review podcast. This is a monthly podcast where I crack open the journals and read the articles so you don't have to. If you like what you hear and have the time, please go to iTunes and write a review for the podcast. It really helps out. If you have any suggestions for articles or comments on the podcast, don't forget to email info@gipearls.com. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter @GI_pearls. This is episode 27 for the month of December 2018. Lots of interesting articles today, including a new set of guidelines. So let's get started. Ustekinumab, Yostelara, which is an interleukin-12-23 antibody approved for treatment of Crohn's disease. It's now been around for a while, but how good is it for inducing endoscopic remission, the real stuff that we now care about? Not just the so-called clinical remission based on extensive questionnaire composite scores of how patients feel, which is important, but if your colon or small bowel is still inflamed, that won't help you much. Gastroenterology has published a sub-study of over 300 patients who were enrolled in three randomized trials involving Stelara versus placebo. These patients were enrolled in these three trials and they had a colonoscopy at baseline at week 8 and about a year after starting ustekinumab. So if you read the conclusion sentence of the abstract of this paper, it reads, in an analysis of data from three trials of patients with moderate to severe Crohn's, ustekinumab, intravenous induction and sub-Q maintenance, reduces endoscopic activity score compared with placebo. We observed significant reduction in endoscopic disease activity at week 8 of induction therapy with ustekinumab. So, excellent. Let's go out and celebrate. Meaning that if you just read the abstract, you'll be under the impression that this drug is amazing and people will be very happy on it. But reading the paper further, you see a problem. If you even glance at the last figure of the paper, where you look at what happens about a year after you start this drug, and I would argue this is what patients really care about, not the how I feel about 2 months after starting the drug, but how I feel overall, maybe a year later. So again, according to the abstract, after induction therapy, the mean score of ustekinumab versus placebo was significantly reduced, 2.7 versus 0.7 with a good p-value, but unfortunately there were no significant improvements in endoscopic response. If you define it at least 50% score reduction, 20% versus 13%, or mucosal healing, absence of ulcerations, 9% versus 4%, and that's at week 8. What about a year later? At 52 weeks, there were no significant improvements in SES-CD scores in treatment versus placebo groups, 2.5 versus 1.9%, and mucosal healing, 13% versus 4.2%. But the p-value was horrendous, meaning there is no improvement in clinically important mucosal healing on this drug. So based on this paper, it would appear that ustekinumab is way less effective than any of the anti-TNF drugs out there. And I know this is apples to oranges, it's not a direct comparison, but you probably can still tell patients that anti-TNF drugs will more likely to get them in remission percentage-wise at 44 weeks or about a year after starting a medicine compared to ustekinumab. And remember, ustekinumab was pretty much approved for inducing clinical remission, not endoscopic remission. Very disappointing. So which anticoagulant is safest for patients to use? From the GI perspective, of course. The authors of this next study coming out from Nashville, Tennessee, looked at over 1 million Medicare claims of people who started oral anticoagulants over 5 years' time and looked at upper GI bleeds. This study was published in JAMA. Based on this paper, apixaban appears to be the safest from the GI bleed perspective of all the anticoagulants out there, but that's not all. You can also reduce the risk even further if you use a PPI. An overall ranking is as follows. Apixaban is safest, followed by warfarin, then dabigatran, and then rivaroxaban in the last place. Although the differences between all the medications are trivial overall, 73 to 100 events per 10,000 on the extreme end. And this agrees with a Canadian study that I reviewed in episode 14, which also found apixaban to be safest in terms of GI bleeds. Granted, it's a retrospective study, but it's still useful to know what's happening out there. So maybe PPIs are not so bad after all, especially if you're an anticoagulant. Alexander Koritz and his group from University of Minnesota have always been a voice of reason when it comes to microbiome, which is why there's no surprise when they published a clinician guide to microbiome testing, which was published in Digestive Disease Science. If, as a primary care doc or GI doc, you're already doing some sort of weird microbiome testing in your patients or even thinking about doing it, please read this. Here are some pearls I took away from this review. 1. No one is denying that microbiome is important. There is some sort of signal there. associations with various disease states, and microbiome certainly gets altered, and more importantly, varies from person to person based on both genotype and phenotype of the host. Two, sequencing machines are a dime a dozen these days, and many companies offer all sorts of fancy testing. This review offers a glossary of what exactly terms like dysbiosis, mutualism, and more specific terms like taxon and alpha diversity really mean. So know these terms so you don't sound like a putz when you're discussing microbiome. The third pearl is for those who long for the time of our ancestors, the cavemen, the cavewomen. Back then, chances are you not only had bacteria in your gut, but you also were likely full of parasites, helminths, and protozoa. So please keep that in mind. 4. We ultimately still don't know what the heck the microbes in our gut do. We have some clues, but we are far from figuring out exactly how to manipulate this microbiome for useful purposes. And I finished with a quote from the review. While the premise behind individual microbiome testing is to inform personalized diagnosis and therapies, the current body of knowledge is not sufficient to allow for meaningful diagnoses, given the high degree of inter-individual variability in the microbiome. And another one. Physicians should question the ethical boundaries challenged by some of the biotech companies engaged in microbiome diagnostics. Here they speak of the fact that patient data may be used without patient's permission for other things. Bottom line, microbiome testing panels are out there, but as of now, they're completely meaningless. And this group from University of Minnesota also publishes great papers, so be on the lookout for those. Let's say you have a 30-year-old patient who was just diagnosed with moderate ulcerative colitis, say Mayo endoscopic score 2 all throughout the colon, meaning there is moderate inflammation. You start them on 5-ASA, I don't know, acicol, because that's what the insurance covers. A year goes by and she's doing great, and now she's having too many flares and getting steroids left and right and can't stay symptom-free. And you say to yourself, enough is enough. The patient says, oh my goodness, let's do something. Let's go into that therapy you were talking about initially that I didn't want, and I think I'm ready to start a biologic. And you do, and she does great. Now, do you stop the 5-ASA, or do you continue it? There was some evidence of efficacy initially for this patient. Now they're on 2 drugs and doing great. So I guess what I'm asking, what is the benefit, if any, continuing 5-ASA when you are on a biologic? Or asking a different way, is there any harm to stopping 5-ASA? At this point, society guidelines don't really say much on this topic. But now there's a paper in Gut Journal from Ryan Onagro, who is a newly minted assistant professor at Mount Sinai in New York City, and Berkeley Limitkai from Stanford. So they looked at 2 patient populations, US and Denmark, and they compared patients who stopped 5-ASA versus those who continued while on a biologic. And they looked for these events: need for steroids, surgery, or colitis-related hospitalization. And conclusion here was that you can probably safely stop 5-ASA if you started an anti-TNF drug recently, as this was not associated with an increased risk of these events, meaning no more steroids, no more surgeries, or no more hospitalizations resulted from stopping the 5-ASA. Okay, fine, it's a retrospective data set, but still interesting. Taking less drugs is always good. So now that you know how much I love negative studies, how about studies that make things worse? It appears that aspirin's free ride as a cure-all may be coming to an end. New England Journal published a trial of aspirin in healthy elderly. It's called the Esprit trial and was done in community-dwelling healthy older folks over 70 who were randomized to aspirin 100 milligrams or placebo. Overall, there was no difference in disability-free survival, likely meaning there was no less strokes or MIs over a period of 5 years, but led to a higher rate of major hemorrhage from placebo. And this is especially interesting given all the positive studies coming out showing that taking aspirin prevents colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, and maybe even esophageal cancer. I highly recommend you listen to the Curbsiders podcast episode 128 if you want to hear more on this issue. But basically, in this study, healthy adults over 70, there was no benefit from taking aspirin, which is too bad. And that's all I'm going to say about that. And now for something unusual, Corey Siegel does very nice research up in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and his group finally published their paper on the use of hyperbaric oxygen therapy for ulcerative colitis patients. This was a pilot study that had to be terminated early since they never got enough patients, but this was a small phase 2a trial for Mayo endoscopic score 2 or higher ulcerative colitis patients who were randomized to steroids plus hyperbaric oxygen or steroids plus hyperbaric sham therapy, looking for clinical response. So even though this was a very tiny study, there was a difference in the rates of colectomies and statistically significant difference in achievement of clinical remission, with half of the 10 patients achieving remission versus zero in the sham group. It's interesting that there was no difference in CRP, as I would expect it to go down somewhat. I don't know how much hyperbaric therapy costs, but I bet it's cheaper than colectomy. So anyway, very promising work, and I hope there's a follow-up study of some sort. And here comes another Elliott Tapper joint. Always a good thing. It is published in the British Medical Journal for some reason, but hey, it's open access, and I love it. So what he did here is an observational study of what is happening to the rates of deaths from cirrhosis and liver cancer in the US over the past 15 years or so. Using the data directly from the CDC, what they found was that mortality from cirrhosis is going up, up, and up. No surprise there. Men are dying at twice the rates of women and have about four times the burden of hepatocellular carcinoma. Asians and Pacific Islanders have a highest HCC mortality rate. If you want to see how your state is doing compared to others in terms of cirrhosis and HCC, there are good tables and graphs. Mortality has been rising since 2009, especially in young people, and especially in Kentucky, New Mexico, and Arkansas. Maryland has consistently done better than other states for some reason. Are they doing something different? Hey, folks in Maryland, what are you doing differently? So again, more big picture on numbers rather than reasons in this paper. One thing that Elliott Tapper thinks is responsible for rising rates since 2009 is the 2008 recession, and that's certainly possible. Next paper is interesting. In one corner, we have American Cancer Society and National Cancer Institute, both of which do not support screening for hepatocellular carcinoma and cirrhotics. In the other corner, we have all the liver societies that recommend liver ultrasound with or without AFP every 6 months to screen for HCC and cirrhotics. So who will win? This is becoming less and less clear by the year. Gastro has published a paper by Andrew Moon from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who looked if screening for HCC reduced cancer-related mortality in cirrhotics. Historically, last two trials were conflicting, and Americans said that it doesn't apply to them since it was done in China. Well, here's a study from the US, and they looked at the VA patients, and since we can't really do a randomized trial anymore, since screening for HCC in cirrhotics is the standard of care now, case control study becomes the next best thing, or pretty much the only thing you can do. So they looked at patients who died of HCC versus those who didn't die of HCC. And according to the study of about 200 patients, there were no differences in screening rates of these patients or AFP values. So what that means is that screening likely did not help those who didn't die of HCC. Based on this, no one is going to stop screening, unless a few other healthcare systems confirm these findings. But if this is confirmed, what are we going to do then? Are we just going to give up on screening for HCC? Maybe we'll have some sort of fancier screening for HCC with biomarkers, which will cost an arm and a leg, of course. Not that ultrasounds are that inexpensive either, but at least they're widely available. What do you tell your patients who are planning on breastfeeding while on a biologic? More importantly, does the antibody get into the breast milk? This next paper took breast milk of mothers feeding their infants and measured concentrations of all known biologics used for IBD. Turns out that all of the currently used biologics could be detected in breast milk. And closer it was to the infusion, the higher the concentration. But what's most important here is that there was no detectable effect on rate of infections or developmental milestones achieved when compared to no breastfeeding. This paper also talks about how 10% of women who were told not to breastfeed while on a biologic by their physician, and 40% of those who did not breastfeed did it because of fear of biologics causing harm. So based on this paper, it's probably low risk, since it's IgA and not IgG is predominantly found in breast milk. And more importantly, if a patient decides to continue biologic during pregnancy, there's probably way more drug transferred via placenta compared to breast milk overall. So as of now, it appears that breastfeeding is probably safe, which is great news. Which bariatric surgery is best? Well, there were plenty of papers kind of trying to figure this out. And really, there are only two surgeries that are left, sleeve and Roux-en-Y, with almost no gastric bands being put in these days. This next study is a retrospective observational study of the National Patient-Centered Clinical Research Network sample, and they looked at 32,000 Roux-en-Y bypasses, 29,000 sleeves, and 3,000 or so gastric bands. Then they looked at 1, 3, and 5 years later to see what happens to the weight loss. And they looked at 30-day complication rates as well. And as I mentioned before, there were other studies, even randomized trials, showing how effective bariatric surgery is. But this one is a good retrospective data to have since there are so many patients in this database, and you get really, really nice graphs in terms of what an average should be for weight loss to be expected for each patient. And in this paper, figure 2 is probably the most useful since it shows 5 years worth of data comparing these three surgery types to each other. And you can really see how terrible gastric band is compared to the other two. Less than 10% of body weight loss at 5 years for it. Really, no one should be getting these anymore. And there's a steady 10% difference between sleeve and Ruin Y, favoring the latter, of course. This is interesting since I saw other studies trying to show that there's no difference between these two surgeries. Another interesting point in the paper in the subgroup analysis was that if you were obese, but BMI less than 50, older than 65, you lost more weight with sleeve compared to Ruin Y. So I guess a bit of a Simpson effect here going on. You can slice and dice data in many ways, but for studying comparative effectiveness on a scale that is independent of individual institutions or even region, this is probably the best study out there. We all know that things like smoking and GERD are strongly associated with esophageal adenocarcinoma. Smoking can be fixed by quitting, GERD can be fixed with PPIs, lifestyle, etc., and sometimes one has to resort to anti-reflux surgery. So what happens to the risk of esophageal cancer after anti-reflux surgery? Looking at about 50,000 patients with these types of surgeries in a study published in JAMA Oncology, risk of esophageal cancer decreased in a time-dependent manner after surgery, compared with general population. But this risk didn't change in the surgical patients compared with patients who received medication only. So it appears that there is no difference between PPIs or surgery in terms of reduction of esophageal adenocarcinoma risk. As long as you treat GERD, doesn't matter how you do it, I guess you get your risk of cancer down. And conclusion of the paper is these findings support the hypothesis that anti-reflux medication and anti-reflux surgery are associated with reduced risk of esophageal adenocarcinoma in patients with GERD. All right, this is big. A new clinical practice guidelines from Canada has been published, and this one has been fully endorsed by the AGA, which pretty much means that this is the law of the land in the good old USA. So this is a clinical practice guidelines on screening for colorectal cancer in individuals with family history of non-hereditary colon cancer or adenoma. I'm going to give you my takeaways from this very important guideline. 1. First degree relatives with colon cancer. So for these patients, colonoscopy should be offered as preferred screening test. FIT testing is now second line. You start at age 40 to 50. Or 10 years younger than the age of diagnosis with either colonoscopy or FIT, but colonoscopy is preferred. How often do you do colonoscopy? Every 5 to 10 years as screening intervals, and FIT testing every 1 to 2 years. So bottom line here is for patients with one first degree relative with colon cancer, you do colonoscopies every 5 to 10 years. So what happens when you have two or more first degree relatives with colon cancer? For these patients, colonoscopy is again preferred. Fecal immunochemical testing is no longer an option. You start again at age 40 or 10 years before first diagnosis in the family, and your interval screenings with colonoscopy is now a solid 5 years, no more 5 to 10 years. What happens if a patient has one or more second degree relative with colon cancer? For these patients, you start at age 50 and basically treat these people as average risk. What about patients with one or more first degree relative with advanced adenoma? Here there are no recommendations on preferred screening test of choice, but colonoscopy or FIT over all others. You start at age 40 or 10 years before the advanced adenoma diagnosis, and the screening colonoscopy should be done 5 to 10 years, and FIT testing 1 to 2 years. And finally, if your patient has a relative with a non-advanced adenoma, by the way, good luck trying to figure that out, exact size of adenoma. Your patient's dear brother Billy had a colonoscopy 7 years ago in another state by a gastroenterologist who is now retired, and maybe Aunt Millie has a report somewhere in her barn. Good luck. Anyway, non-advanced adenoma in a first-degree relative, screen these patients as average risk. One of the conclusions I came up with is that they pretty much killed off FLEX-SIG and CT colonography. I mean, there's only so many times you can say which test is preferred before all others really disappear. And keep in mind that at the end of the day, more than half of your patients will end up having a relative with something. So more than half of your patients will be screened with these tests now. The second conclusion here is that, and I'm sure you've noticed this already, is that age 60 is no longer a viable threshold. So if your father gets colon cancer at age 103, you are now on the hook for colonoscopy every 5 years. Well, technically 5 to 10 years, but who's going to wait 10 years? Guidelines do have that 5 number in there. I think the real winner in these guidelines is the FIT testing. It's all over these guidelines. And based on these guidelines, you'd think that AGA has completely lost its mind, but you'd be wrong because there is a voice of reason. Since there is an editorial in the same issue by Philip Schoenfeld from Michigan VA, and here are some things that Dr. Schoenfeld has to say. One thing that the guidelines recommend is documenting presence of an advanced adenoma in a first-degree relative with histology or endoscopy reports, but patients barely know when their last colonoscopy was, or what was found, and much less likely to know what their brothers or parents or sisters had on their colonoscopy. And how the heck are we supposed to get their colonoscopy and histology reports? It's almost impossible. Here's a quote from the editorial. This step is a nuisance and does not seem like a real-world approach. Given the prevalence of adenomas in the average-risk 50 to 59-year-olds, almost 50% of the population will have over one FDR with an adenoma. Offering colonoscopy at age 40 to all these individuals is not realistic, nor is it helpful in preventing colon cancer. I guess American Cancer Society would disagree since they've upped the game recently. And another good quote from the editorial, although it is time-consuming, we should use the available data and our clinical experience to have conversations with individuals about risks, benefits, and preferences instead of reflexively recommending colonoscopy. Yeah, that's going to be hard to do as well, unfortunately. Since in my practice, many of the colonoscopies that I do are direct referrals from primary care docs, so it's hard to have those conversations right there and then when the patient is already prepped. I'm very curious to think what you people think about these new guidelines and whether you're opposed to them or you have some positive things to say about these guidelines as well. Please write to me, info@gipearls.com. Thanks. And I guess we'll end it here on the guidelines. Thanks again for listening to GI Pearls, the Gastroenterology and Hepatology Literature Review podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on the website, gipearls.com, and please, please leave me a review on iTunes. It really, really helps. Happy New Year. I'm not sure what the best paper of the year was. Write to me if you think of one that was the best for 2018. I'm sure I missed a whole bunch of things. You can write to me about those as well, and I'm sure I can sneak them in. Bye-bye.